Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have the Western mainstream media's atrocious double standards in reporting on the suicide attacks in Tartus and Jablay that killed about 100 people and wounded nearly double that. Just imagine for a moment that there were multiple suicide bombings against a bus stop, hospital, and other soft targets in any Western European or North American city. It would be global news. World leaders would be competing with one another to see who can condemn it the loudest. And there'd be solidarity marches and calls of, I am, well, whatever the name of the victimized city or country was. There wouldn't be a single incidence of reporting suggesting that the victims brought their tragic and gruesome deaths upon themselves. But lo and behold, that's not at all how the Western mainstream media treats terrorist attacks in Syria. No way. Guys, I was so appalled at what I saw earlier this week, and I can tell that most of you were disgusted as well. Because my entire Facebook community of like-minded activists was talking about it too. After the terrorists killed about 100 people and wounded almost double that, now imagine guys, just imagine the scale of this carnage happening in a Western European or North American city for a moment. Western mainstream media rags dismissed the attacks as happening in, and I quote what was largely parroted all over the unipolar information space, Assad strongholds. Did anybody ever deign to publicly call the Paris attacks and say that they were happening in an Iran stronghold? Or that the Brussels attacks took place in the NATO and EU stronghold, which, to be fair, is a lot more accurate of a description than saying that coastal Syria is an Assad stronghold? I mean, guys, just because one part of the country has been largely spared from the same intensity of war that has been raging throughout the rest of the country does not mean that it is a stronghold in the sense that the U.S. and its informational allies are trying to convey. What they want to strongly suggest is that the coastal areas are heavily populated with Alawites and that their shared confession with President Assad makes them some kind of sectarian stronghold, thus reinforcing the divide-and-rule nature of the war in Syria and, again, emphasizing identity differences, seemingly irreconcilable if one were to believe the Western lies about the country. And they're doing this in the run-up to the post-Daesh political situation, which I'll talk about later on in the program. In a way, these Western commentators are slanting their reports to make it seem like the coastal areas, Alawites in particular, deserve these terrorist attacks, because their home areas have remained relatively peaceful, with relative being the key word here, and they share the same confession as President Assad. This type of insinuation is disgusting. It's just as offensive as saying that an African American killed in Chicago deserved to die because he or she looks like President Obama and was in an Obama stronghold. What kind of a cesspool has Western journalism turned into? The next one up is the CIA's drone assassination in Pakistan against former Taliban leader Mullah Mansoor and his subsequent replacement with Malawi Haibatullah Akhundzada. So you've all heard about it by now, as well as how this attack violated Pakistan's sovereign airspace. But I'm going to take things in a different direction and tell you all what it means, because, after all, this is Context Countdown. We can tell by the very fact that this attack occurred that the U.S. had accurate and actionable intelligence on the mullah, meaning that they had somehow penetrated his very secure line of communications and were tracking him in real time, being able to confirm as best as they could that it was him before they carried out the daring strike. Secondly, reports have circulated that a passport was found on his body, supposedly confirming that he had traveled a few times to Iran, which, if true, doesn't mean that Tehran knew who he was, but that he simply managed to get a fake passport under an assumed identity. We don't know for sure what he'd be doing there if it is confirmed that he was even in the country to begin with, which is an allegation that Iran vehemently denies. But if it's proven, then the U.S. might use this to ramp up its information attacks against the country. Actually, it could even do this just based on speculation, if it really wants to. The next thing I want to talk to you guys about is his successor, Malawi Haibatullah Akhundzada. I personally don't know much about him, but reading the reports that have come out, he seems to have been a compromise candidate between Sirajuddin Haqqani and Mullah Yaqub, the leader of the fearsome Haqqani network and one of the sons of Mullah Omar, the first Taliban leader, respectively. and both of which are Akhundzada's deputies. Russia earlier warned that Haqqani's appointment as Taliban chief would be a step backwards for the nascent peace process in Afghanistan, and the Taliban, wanting to be taken seriously as a supposedly legitimate political actor in the country one day, might have obviously figured out that it would be best to avoid having this happen. Also, appointing one of Mullah Omar's sons as leader might have also been seen as overly aggressive by the international community, so it makes sense that they settle on someone different from these two, while still giving each of them a formal deputy leadership position. I also think that the Taliban did this because it wants to make its new leader Akhundzada assassination-proof, meaning that the U.S. will think twice about killing him because they don't want Sirajuddin Haqqani or Mullah Yaqub to succeed him, seeing as how they're basically next in line. It's a very shrewd move, if you ask me. But will it be enough to stop Obama from killing the next Taliban chief anyhow? Only time will tell. Third in our countdown is President Obama's decision to lift the arms embargo against Vietnam and the impact that it will have on the South China Sea's stability and American-Chinese relations. Well, I can't say that this was a surprise, even though the Western mainstream media tried to throw everyone off the trail in advance by saying that it was unlikely because of supposed human rights concerns. Not to say I told you so, but I did predict this and the consequences that it will have in detail nearly 2 weeks ago in an article that I wrote for The Durant, which you guys can check out if you're interested. But here on Context Countdown, I'm going to look more specifically at the South China Sea and the U.S.-China aspect of the new Cold War. Vietnam gets about 93% of its military hardware from Russia, and this isn't an arbitrary figure, but one that's quoted by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, the premier global authority on the matter. This means that Moscow helps preserve the military balance and status quo between Hanoi and Beijing, much as it does between Beijing and New Delhi, and Baku and Yerevan. So you guys can see a pattern here, right? It's that Russia tries to stabilize a tense situation and prevent one side or another from acquiring some sort of breakout capacity to totally upset the balance and cause another war. Like it or dislike it, that's the reality of what's happening here. Well, now all of a sudden the U.S. wants to come into the mix and offset the strategic equilibrium between Vietnam and China to Hanoi's favor, which is really bad news for the South China Sea. Like I said, Vietnam gets all but 7% of its military wares from Russia, but its proportion of non-Russian equipment is expected to grow in the coming future, especially after the lifting of this embargo. In and of itself, there's nothing wrong with lifting any type of embargo or sanctions, but what's important here is the intent, which in this case is aimed against a third country, China. Even if the U.S. only chips away a few percentage points into Russia's market share with Vietnam, if it does so with certain air and or sea weapons, then it could really have a huge impact. Many commentators say that Vietnam cannot afford overpriced American hardware, but that just means that a congressional solution will have to be reached, just like with Israel. The U.S. gives about $3 billion a year to Israel, but a lot of it is recycled back into buying American arms, so it's essentially a massive money laundering business for the military-industrial complex, using your tax dollars. Given the premier importance that the U.S. places in the South China Sea, I wouldn't put it past Washington to come up with a similar Israeli-like scheme for supplying Vietnam with a bunch of subsidized weapons in order to contain China. Our runner-up is U.S. CENTCOM leader Joseph Votel's secret visit to the north of Syria earlier this week, and what it presages about the closing stages of the race for Raqqa. As we all know, Allied forces are moving in on Daesh's so-called capital of Raqqa, and this means that the most dramatic stage of the war on terror is quickly drawing to a close, but the war on Syria is still far from being over. Votel illegally went to Syria in order to meet with members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, largely composed of the Kurdish YPG, with just a scattering of anti-government Arab tribesmen thrown in for diversity's sake. While there, he put the finishing touches on the SDF's offensive against Daesh-controlled Raqqa, but he probably also spoke about what will come next after the terrorist group is defeated. And guys, that's the thing, because destroying Daesh is only half of the battle in the war on Syria, since it's what comes afterwards that's just as important. UNSC Resolution 2254 mandates that a constitutional rewriting and new elections be held sometime before June 2017. So it's these two post-Daesh events that both camps are positioning for in the coming future. And by both, what I mean is that the country will predictably split along Federalist and Unitary lines. Or in other words, Kurdish-led anti-government forces, including Salafist Arabs, that favor federalism, or as I call it, internal partitioning, and Damascus-led ones that support an all-inclusive and non-divisive unitary state, like has always existed. I'd like to remind everyone that the Syrian government is totally against this so-called federalization. And to tell you just how much they despise it, I'd like to quote the strong words from the Honorable Syrian Ambassador to Russia, Mr. Riyad Haddad. Responding to the Kurds' unilateral declaration of federalization in mid-March, he said, and I quote, "When one speaks of the federalization of our country, this directly threatens the integrity of our country, runs counter to the Constitution, contradicts the national concepts, even is at variance with the international resolutions and decisions. So all statements of this kind are illegitimate," end quote. But you know, it's for those very same reasons that the U.S. and its allies support this plot. Because they want to complete the internal fracturing of Syria's political and social unity by legalizing it through the upcoming plot to rewrite the Constitution in favor of federalism, which, remember, is just a euphemism for internal partitioning. If the U.S. and its Kurdish and Salafist allies can succeed in doing this, then they create a patchwork of identity-based statelets that could be more easily divided amongst themselves and conquered by Western, Turkish, Israeli, and Gulf forces. So always keep that in mind. Federalization isn't what patriotic Syrians want. It's what Syria's number one enemies want. And they're exploiting gullible and self-interested internal elements to try to achieve this. At our top spot, we've got the government of Poland arresting political dissident Mateusz Piskorski and accusing him of espionage, turning the opposition activist into the country's first political prisoner since the end of communism. Guys, I am so ashamed of what Poland did, and I say this as someone with Polish roots and direct connection to the country. We're all aware by now of the government's massive paranoia in responding to all things even remotely considered to be affiliated to Russia. But I don't think anyone really thought that they'd go this far and do what they just did. What happened was that Mateusz Piskorski, the leader of the new grassroots-founded Zmiana Party, meaning change, was arrested and charged with espionage, with reports alleging that the government accuses him of spying for either Russia and or China. They targeted Piskorski because he is a very, very, very vocal critic of the government's foreign policy and has been organizing like-minded and patriotic Poles through his new political platform. He's also traveled to Moscow, Crimea, and Donbass in the last couple of years, and it's probably for these reasons that he was targeted by his government. While Warsaw has its fair share of problems with contemporary Kiev, it has even more with Moscow, and it might have imprisoned Piskorski on behalf of American and Ukrainian pressure, whispering in Warsaw's ear and exploiting its anti-Russian paranoia that the opposition activist was a spy just for going to Moscow, Crimea, and Donbass. Let's also not forget that Warsaw will be hosting the upcoming NATO summit in July, and that Piskorski had earlier warned right before his arrest that the government would clamp down on dissent in the run-up to this event and try to silence all who oppose it. Lo and behold, that's exactly what they did by arresting Piskorski and charging him with espionage, thus making him Poland's first political prisoner since the end of communism and sending a chill down the spine of all internal dissidents. This was a message aimed not at Russia, which Piskorski was not spying for, but against Poland's own people, against those who are opposed to the government's request for more NATO troops and a permanent presence for them in violation of the Russian NATO Founding Act of 1997, which set out relations between the two sides. If you're Polish and you're against the U.S.'s missile infrastructure in your country, and you dare to speak out about it in public, let alone organize a few of your friends to protest against it, then you might be the next one to be crazily accused of being a Russian spy and promptly arrested. What's more, Piskorski will be held for 3 months because of the secret national security charges that are being leveled against him, meaning that future political prisoners could expect a similar jail stay before they even go to trial. These are really scary times for Poland, but they're probably just the beginning. So guys, there you have it. This is the end of this week's very exciting and dramatic edition of Context Countdown. Like I always do, I want to warmly thank you guys for listening to my program, and I want to also strongly encourage you to share it on social media. Thank you again for supporting my show, and I hope you guys will tune in again next week. Have a nice weekend. Bye.